Okay. All righty, so I want to speak a little bit off topic, but related topic, because everything is related. That is, I want to speak about the seven Haftaras of comfort. We know that we've been through a Tisha B'Av, and in truth, let me share with you a thought that I heard from Rav Soloveitchik, Zichrono Livracha, that I said it on Tisha B'Av, or Sameach, so if you heard it, please forgive me. And that is, you know, the very last kina, or the next to the last kina that we recite, but really one of the most famous, is the only one that is sung to a nigun, and that is Eli Tzion V'Yareha. I have really a very indelible memory of that kina, because I remember when Rav Moshe Feinstein, when I was young, would sometimes come to Hartford, Connecticut for the summers, because he had a relative in Hartford, or we used to say he wanted to go to the only place in the world where they wouldn't ask him any shaylas in halacha. That was our joke. But Rav Moshe was given the honor of saying that last kina, and I still remember his voice, the way he sang, and you felt the whole tsar of the gullus of 2,000 years coming from him. By the way, a simple point, which forgive me if it's so obvious that I shouldn't say it, but I know people sometimes make a mistake. Eli Tzion, I've heard a person say it was Keli Tzion. Very, very incorrect. Eli is not Hashem's name. It does not mean God. But Eli is a verb meaning to lament. You see that? So Eli Tzion V'Yareha. You're calling to Zion and the cities of Zion, all the cities of Eretz Yisrael that have been destroyed, and you're calling on them to lament and to cry and to weep. And it's interesting that is the one kina that we say when we stand up. Now, normally, kinos should be recited sitting either on the ground or a low bench. Now, good, if people have back trouble, and obviously as I get older, I find I have more and more of that trouble, so obviously, you're allowed to stand up if you need to. But optimally, you say it's a sitting down, you know, on the ground or on a very low bench. But Eli Tzion, we bedavka say, getting up. So Rav Soloveitchik gave the following explanation, a beautiful, beautiful explanation. He said that, you know, on one hand, we mourn the Chorban. We're devastated. At least we're supposed to be. Halvai, we would be. But at least the theory of halacha is that there's a Chorban Beis HaMikdash, our life cannot be totally normal. And even though we who are Zocha to be in Eretz Yisrael, and we who are Zocha to even live in Yerushalayim, and you know, people, after the Six-Day War in particular, there was some discussion in rabbinic circles, not in the Haredi world per se, but certainly the Dati Leumi world, and I'm talking about religious Jews, whether the whole bracha of Nachem that we recite on Tisha B'Av ought to be rewritten in some way. Because it does sound, in a literal way, it sounds a little strange. We talk about the city that is abandoned, that is desolate, that is burnt. I mean, how do you say that when Baruch Hashem, okay, we don't have a Beis HaMikdash, that's true. But to talk about the city in all of the terms of Nachem, it seems to be untrue. And there were actually some Rabbanim, not that many, but there were some Rabbanim that we're saying, listen, we got to change the nusach a little bit, simply because it does not correspond with the mitzvahs. But the answer would be, number one, we don't tamper with nusach. That's a general rule. But number two, the concept of describing the physical desolation of Jerusalem is essentially a metaphor for the spiritual desolation. In the same way that you can be ill even without the symptoms. So even if the physical manifestations are not quite there, because Baruch Hashem, things have gotten so much better in so many ways, but the spiritual malaise of not having the Shekhinah with us, not having prophecy, not having Geula, not having a Beis HaMikdash, the Sinas Chinam, the divisiveness, which is like a cancer within us, it's still here. So when we talk about a destroyed city, we don't necessarily mean that the buildings are desolate. Baruch Hashem, there's a lot of building going on. And we have to be very, very grateful for that. But it means that in a spiritual sense, we are still wrecked. We are still destroyed. We are still devastated. There are people alive today, of course, who still remember the Holocaust. And many of us certainly have parents, grandparents, aunts and uncles who either died in the Holocaust or survived the Holocaust but remember what it was. So the notion of the Chorban Beis HaMikdash is not such a foreign idea of thousands and thousands of years ago. It's something that is still within the memory of people, that is alive even today. So as a result, we still mourn the Chorban Beis HaMikdash. But at the same time, Hashem decrees, you can't allow yourself to be paralyzed with grief. You have to move on. You have to rebuild. You know, sometimes a person can get so overwhelmed with sadness that they literally cannot move on. And it's Hashem's decree that we get up from our mourning. That's why we get up. We get up, even on Tisha B'Av, as if to say, it is time to rebuild. But here is the point. When you get up, you don't get up by forgetting the Chorban Beis HaMikdash. You don't kind of say, oh, okay, I've done my mourning, and now life is going to be regular. You get up, but you take the memory of the Chorban with you. That's the significance of a kina that you recite as you're getting up. As if to say, there are two ideas here that are operating at the same time. Idea number one is, you got to get up. Idea number two is, but don't forget your avelus. Take it with you. This is the very strange paradox of time, in a sense. On one hand, in order to go on with life generally, one has to have a certain amount of forgetfulness or detachment. Right? You can't, right? In fact, Chazal tell us, when we lose a relative, so the mace is forgotten from the heart after a year. Now, forgotten from the heart does not mean you forget, but it means that the grief is not as intense as it was. Because if the grief would be at its fullest intensity, you couldn't go on. So on one hand, we have to forget. And on the other hand, we always have to remember. We always have to remember. By the way, let me just say this happens to be my own father's yahrzeit, Zichrono Livracha, so I would also like, in addition to, I'm sorry, I should announce it. Yeah, so Mel David is our usual sponsor. He should be in good health. And in addition, I would like to dedicate it Lezecher Nishmas Avi Mori, David Ben Moshe, and he's Zichro Boruch. So it's interesting that a lot of what I'm saying also applies to a yahrzeit as well. So on one hand, you got to forget, but you also have to remember. You know, if you think about this, in the early years of the 20th century, if you looked at the American Jewish population, you actually had some very distinguished rabbanim in crazy places you would never expect. Omaha, Nebraska, South Dakota, different places. There were actually big Talmidei Chachamim. And for various reasons, most of their children became totally non-observant, and basically a lot of these great rabbanim literally have no descendants that are Jewish, if they have any descendants at all. And part of it came from a certain philosophy that America was so treif, America was so different, that you could never create what you had in Vilna or Minsk or Brisk. No matter what you do, it would only be a pale shadow of that. So what's the use? Now, when you had people like Rav Moshe Feinstein and Aaron Cutler, who came a little later, their idea was a little different. Their idea was, okay, we're not going to have Brisk or Vilna. In other words, you can't be so connected to the past that you're not able to be flexible in responding to a new situation. But we can have something good. Right? What's the saying? I quote it very often from Voltaire, although someone told me it's not Voltaire, that the best is the enemy of the better. And what that means is...
The best is the enemy of the good.
Okay, the better or the good. Okay, it's the same idea. And the idea there is that when you have a certain notion that the only thing that's worthwhile is perfection, and you're not going to get that perfection, you sometimes don't bother to do anything at all, when in fact you could have made things better, even if it would. So yeah, we're not going to have Vilna, we're not going to have Bris. But we can have Torah, we can have mitzvos, we can have gehilos. So, which means in a sense, in order to rebuild, you've got to forget what the past was and look at what you have now, but at the same time connect to the past as your source of inspiration. And the Churban Beis HaMikdash is the very same thing. Hashem decrees you have to go on. But when you go on, you don't forget at the same time. And that's the concept of standing up and saying the kina. As it were, the Churban Beis HaMikdash should be in our mind every single day. Every single day. The very first paragraph of the Shulchan Aruch says, Ra'oi l'chol yirei shemayim. Every person has yirei shemayim, should be meitzar v'dayeg al ha'chorban, should be thinking and being sad over the korban every single day. They tell the story about Rav Elia Lapyan, who is a great, great Baal Musar. Great, great Baal Musar. He was nifter around 30 years ago. And he was already very old. He was already in his 80s. And he started the custom of tikkun chatzos, of getting up at midnight and mourning over the Beis HaMikdash. Even though he was already in his 80s, it was not easy for him. So someone asked him, like, why are you starting it now? I mean, for 80 years you didn't do this. So he says, well, he feels he's approaching the end of his life, although Baruch Hashem, he lived well into his 90s. And when we die, after 120 years, Hashem gives us a test on the Shulchan Aruch. How much of the Shulchan Aruch did we keep? So Rav Elia Lapyan said the following. All right, the stuff that's in chapter 600, Siman Tav Resh, okay, so if I don't keep something that's there already, but I have a lot of, you know, I've said yes to a lot of things, so I built up a track record, so I'm not so worried about the stuff that's Hilchos Rosh Hashanah, Hilchos Sukkot, Hilchos Chanukah, Hilchos Purim, because by the time the Malach that's giving me the test gets there, hopefully I'll have a lot of yeses. But this is on page one, worrying about the Beis HaMikdash. If I start the first question on the test, I'm going to get wrong, you know. Actually, I can tell you, of course, certainly Menachem, I'm sure, is a very fair grader. We know that. But I can tell you, you know, I myself graded law school examinations for many years. And I can tell you, indeed, that if initial answers make a bad impression, there's a midas hadin on the whole paper that comes across at that point. So there is something to be said that even in an examination, you want to make a good first impression. Yeah, I try to compensate, but again, there's always going to be that type of bias and the like. Okay, so that is the idea of going on. And again, think about the Holocaust. Again, this may be people that you know in your own family, how people lost their spouses, they lost their children. And they went on. And they started new families. And they started a new life. And they came to a country, whether it was Eretz Yisrael or America or even other countries in Europe, England, where they didn't know the language. And they didn't have that many government programs to assist them in those days. And they built a life. They built a life with courage and dedication. And they didn't allow themselves to be crushed. They didn't allow themselves to be demoralized. In fact, in this connection, Rav Soloveitchik said another very beautiful thought. This was a very tragic year in his life. In the 1960s, he lost three close relatives in succession. His brother, Reb Shmuel, his mother, and then finally his wife. And mamish, one after the other. And it was very, very devastating. And although he continued to give shiurim for a number of years, more than 20 years after that happened, but many people who know him well say he never recovered emotionally, that there was a difference between what he was before and what he was afterwards. And one can understand that one might not be able to totally recover. But at the end of his last shiva, of the three shivas, he said a thought that Chazal teach us that before this world, there were many other worlds that Hashem had made, and Hashem had destroyed them. Bore olamos umachrivan. In fact, according to some interpretations, that might be a key to the scientific problem of age of the earth, in which, you know, on one hand, the Torah seems to say that the world is only 5,779 years. On the other hand, we come up with billions of years. One of the terutzim is that when Chazal say he created worlds and destroyed them, that does not mean other planets, but rather the earth itself underwent cataclysmic changes, whether it was ice ages, meteorite showers, which means to say Genesis, the book of Bereshit, is only the present iteration of the world, but there were prior worlds. That would be an answer to the age of the earth, that are pre-Bereshit worlds. What was the purpose of that? Well, that's the interesting question, because those worlds presumably did not have human beings. That's where the dinosaurs existed, etc. But the point was, why would Hashem create all of these worlds and then destroy them? Why didn't he just get it right? Of course, even this world was effectively destroyed with the Mabul. So he said, Hashem went through this exercise to teach us an important lesson, he said. That even if the worlds that you created with so much love have to get destroyed, you go on and you create new worlds. Borei Olam HaSamachriban is the divine message that even when your world is destroyed, he was talking about himself, you have to go on and you have to rebuild. And this really was always the message of Klal Yisrael. But when you rebuild, on one hand, as I said before, you have to distance yourself from the past and at the same time connect yourself to the past at the same time. It's very, very difficult. It's very difficult. I mean, I myself, knew Balabatim in different shuls who were not Gedolim in any way, but they kind of poo-pooed like everything that was going on in America. This yeshiva, that yeshiva, because it's nothing like Europe, nothing like, well, you know, which may be true, 100% true. But you see, when you have that cynicism, that negativity, it's because you're too connected to a particular past with the feeling that if you can't replicate it, there's no use in doing anything else. And that's not emes, right? The old saying, a half loaf is better than no loaf, certainly applies to mitzvahs. The Chayvus Alavavus writes that in Ruchnius, in spirituality, there is no such thing as something that is so small or insignificant that it doesn't matter. By the way, that's true for Averis as well. Meaning, there's no such thing as an Avera that's too small. And, Baruch Hashem, there's no such thing as a mitzvah that's too insignificant. Every little thing counts. In fact, they tell the story about the Vilna Gaon, that the Vilna Gaon, for various reasons, was in prison two or three times for short-term sentences, etc. Either loitering, again, some connected to the Hasidim, some connected to when the Vilna Gaon was traveling as a young man. He didn't have the papers that you needed to travel around Europe. But he was sharing a cell with a Jewish guy who was in prison for committing murder. He was not a religious Jew, and he got drunk and he killed somebody. Now, it's very unusual. Baruch Hashem, there are not that many Jewish murderers. We are mainly in white-collar crime. we're not, Yidden, Baruch Hashem, are not in violent crimes, usually. But this was a guy that was a murderer. And when they brought bread to eat and water, so the Vilna Gaon used the water for Netilat Yadayim, and the other guy just started eating the bread. So the Vilna Gaon said to him, you have to wash your hands before you eat bread. So the person started laughing. He was a big, big guy. He takes his big, burly hands and says, these hands have crushed necks and smashed skulls. You're telling me Hashem cares if I pour water on them before I eat bread? And the Vilna Gaon says, what does one thing have to do with the other? Yeah, rotsayach is a very, very bad thing. You still have to wash your hands. It's not that Hashem is not going to count your netilat shadayim because you're a rotsayach. Those are separate cheshbonos. In fact, the Rambam writes that if a person does like a million mitzvos and a million averos, it's not the pshat that the averos cancel out the mitzvah. Hashem keeps two different ledgers. It's not like he aggregates, which means, yeah, we will be held to account for every avera, but an avera will not take away the reward of a mitzvah. The mitzvah still counts. So no matter how big of a rasha a person is, he does not lose the mitzvahs that they've done, that he's done, even though there are averas for which there has to be a din b'cheshbon. Okay, so that is point number one I wanted to make with some elaboration. Rav Soloveitchik's point of why Eli Tzion V'Arara is said while we stand up. We're getting up. We're rejoining life. Very, very important not to be in a state of perpetual grief and mourning. Now, there's another point, and that is, if you go back to the poem itself, which, by the way, is anonymous. We don't know who wrote Eli Tzion. Most of the kinos were written by the very, very famous religious poet, Rabbi Elazar HaKalir, who wrote much of the extra piyutim in liturgy, most of the Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, extra things, are Rabbi Elazar HaKalir. Most of the kinos, not all, most of the kinos of Tisha B'Av are Rabbi Elazar HaKalir. If you still belong to the small number of shuls that say Yotzros on the four Parshios, that is Rabbi Elazar HaKalir. And by the way, what we say and what's in the Machzor and what's in the Siddur is only a fraction of what he wrote. You could multiply it by 10 or 20 times more in terms of what he wrote, and a lot of it didn't make the Machzor or the Siddur. And even what made the Machzor is sometimes Bekitzer, it's an abridgment, but over the centuries, Kehilos cut things out and the like. So Elazar HaKalir was an enormously prolific poet. And in all of his poems, there are many allusions to Midrashim and Chazal. So if you don't know the Midrashim, you wouldn't even know what he's talking about. So the commentaries have to tell you this line refers to this Midrash and the like. But be it as it may, Rabbi Elazar HaKalir wrote most of the kinos, but Eli Tzion V'Arara he did not write, and we don't know who wrote it. But note what it says. Lament, Zion and the cities, you shall lament, cry, wail, mourn. Kamo Isha Bitsireha, like a woman going through the travail of labor. V'chipsula chaguhasak, and like a young virgin bride who never even got to know her husband well, who is wearing sackcloth because she has lost the beloved husband of her youth. Now note the two metaphors. She cries like a woman going through the labor of childbirth, and like a young woman that has lost her beloved husband. Now think of the difference in the metaphor. The common denominator is that there's pain. It hurts. And because it hurts, you scream and you cry. But there's a very big difference. When a woman is crying the pains of labor, at least in the normal course of events, that will culminate in a birth, that will culminate in a joy. On the other hand, the sobbing, the crying of the widow that has lost her husband, at least in this world, that is a pain that is not going to be restored. Maybe there'll be another Shidduch HaMitzvah, something like that, but in terms of this particular loss until Tchiyas HaMeisim is permanent. So the mixing of the metaphors, the woman in childbirth and the woman that has been bereft of her husband, may be suggesting the following idea. When the Jewish people experience Chorban, Galus, maybe the Holocaust, whatever it would be, they felt as if they were widowed from God, as if God has abandoned them, God has left them. In fact, we shouldn't even say it, but the whole famous book by a Reform rabbi, God is dead, Rachmana Litzlan, we shouldn't say the words, but that was a phrase that was invoked after the Holocaust, which is mamash, the image of being a widow. Yirmiyahu uses the image of widowhood. Eicha Yashva Vadat. How has the widow sat all in isolation? Hoir Rabasiyam Haisa Talmana. But that's not true. Klal Yisrael thinks their suffering is the suffering of a widow. In reality, it is the suffering of a woman in labor, that through the suffering will come birth and redemption and simcha. So it's mixing it. From your perspective, you may think it's permanent, like a widow. In reality, it's a process that leads to a birth. And indeed, that's what we read in the Haftorah. Next week's Haftorah, it'll say, Rani akara lo yalada, rejoice, barren woman who has not given birth. Because indeed, this will be the process of giving birth. And that is why, of course, we call all of the stages before Mashiach, we call them Chavlei Mashiach. Chavlei Mashiach. The birth pains of Mashiach. Is it painful? Yes, it is painful. It hurts. But one has to understand that it is a pain that leads to birth. And that is those were the two observations I wanted to share with you on the Piyot Eli Tzion V'Yareha. Now, we know that right after Tisha B'Av, we go to 7 weeks until Rosh Hashanah, and those 7 weeks have special haftoras, and those haftoras are lav dafka linked to the parsha. Normally, a haftorah is connected to the parsha of the week, but for these 7 weeks, sometimes it's connected, sometimes it's not. But the Chazal enacted that the haftoras be connected to the theme of nechama, of comforts. And all 7 weeks, all of the seven haftorahs of comfort, are taken from the Navi Yeshayahu. Yeshayahu is the great Navi of comfort. Interestingly enough, just to remind people of the chronology, Yeshayahu was more than 100 years before the Churban. Yeshayahu is comforting about the Geula way before there was even a Churban Beis HaMikdash, but nevertheless, he is the great prophet of comfort. And therefore, these 7 weeks are called Shiva Denechemta, the 7 weeks of comfort. The 3 weeks before Tisha B'Av, where we have Haftorahs of tragedy, are called Shalosh de Paranusa, in Aramaic, the three of tragedy, of catastrophe. And then we have Sheva de Nechemta, and that takes us to Rosh Hashanah. And Rosh Hashanah, we have the theme of Tshuva, Shalosh, three Haftorahs, dealing with Tshuva. Rosh Hashanah, Tzom Gedal, Yom Kippur, dealing with Tshuva. So look at the pattern here. Paranus, tragedy. Tshuva, I'm sorry, Nechama, comfort. Then Tshuva. Now, 2 points about the seven haftorahs of comfort. First of all, you'll notice that the ratio of comfort to tragedy is more than double. Three haftorahs of sadness, seven haftorahs of comfort. That's the way life is. When a child has been hurt and needs to be reassured of the parent's love, or even in a marriage sometimes, if God forbid, there has been harshness between husband and wife, you can't just take it back by doing the same. Meaning to say, you said, you know, five hurtful words, you got to pay interest. You can't just say five kind words. You may have to do 10, 20, 30, 100, a million. Now, you may have to do much, much more to undo the pain. So too, Hashem has to give us more than double the comfort. And this explains another aspect of the Shiva Dinechemta. You know, for those of you that have ever had the occasion of teaching Tanakh, you may encounter the difficulty in high school or whatever, you may encounter the difficulty that teaching a sefer like Yeshayahu is a very, very, very difficult sefer to teach. Why? Because there isn't much of a storyline. When you learn Nevi'im Rishonim, Yehoshua, Shoftim, Shmuel, Malachim, things are happening. So there's a story, right? So we get engrossed in stories. Yeshayahu are pronouncements about redemption and Gehula, but there is no event I mean, there's a little bit of history in Yeshayahu, but the book is not a historical book, per se. Now, the problem can be underscored if you look at the Shiva Dinachamta. Let's say somebody asks you, okay, we have seven Haftoros of comfort. Summarize to me the first Haftorah in two lines. So, you'll say, well, God is comforting us after the Galus, and he's telling us there'll be a Geula. Okay, short and sweet summary. Okay, summarize the second Haftorah of comfort. Well, really the same thing. Third, same thing. Fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh. So we have seven Haftorahs that are just saying the same thing over and over and over again? Why do I need the same thing over and over and over again? So, some Mefarshim, like the Malbim really goes through a superhuman heroic effort. You know, the Malbim has a shita. The Malbim lived in the 19th century. That there is no such thing as a synonym in biblical Hebrew. Meaning to say, if one pasuk says simcha and another says sason, gila, so even if English translates it all happiness, joy, etc., there would be a synonym. You have to give a separate, unique meaning to each word. Actually, this is the approach of the Gra as well. The Gra really did it first. So as a result, the way the Malbim tries to work through repetition is by saying, oh, it's not repetition. Rather, this word means this, and this word means this, and this word means this. But I'll tell you that although we're kind of used to understanding Tanakh that way, many Rishonim did not have a problem with repetition. You will find in the Radak, for example, and in the Ibn Ezra, a phrase, Kefel Ha'inyan B'milim Shonot. It's repeating something, different words, poetic variation. Meaning, unlike the Malbim and the Gra, who say we have to find a different meaning. And I have to say that sometimes, at least in the case of the Malbim, it's a little artificial, frankly. He's so committed that he has to find a different meaning that, you know, he just pushes and pushes and pushes till he gets a different meaning. But the Radak and the Ibn Ezra says, no, it's all the same. Well, so then the question becomes, well, if the psukim are not different, it's all the same, then we're back to the question, why repeat it seven times? The answer is, I think repetition gets a bad rap. It's actually much more important than you might think, even if it's the same message. Many people say, I've read, that one of the memories, you know, there's certain memories that everybody has that are indelible. For example, at least if you're an American, they say most people remember exactly where they were if you were alive then, when Kennedy was assassinated. And I remember I was walking home from school, it was Friday afternoon. On the other hand, because that introduced a lot of other assassinations in the following year, you know, maybe you have less of a memory where you were, where RFK was assassinated or Martin Luther King, because at that point, unfortunately, it was it became more of a commonplace. So one of the memories that people say that you remember is the first time you were separated from your mother. In other words, when you were lost. You know, you're walking in a park or something, and for a moment, you don't know where your mom is, so there's a little bit of, am I abandoned? Am I going to be an orphan forever and ever? So I remember that myself. I remember that I was in a department store with my mother, and I stopped to look at the toys for a moment as she was walking, and she turned a corner, and I looked around. I didn't know where she was. And I said, abandoned forever, who will take care of me? You know. Now it literally was 5 seconds. It was not a big deal. And in those days, life was safer anyway, so if a kid had to wander around, it wasn't like today. It wasn't the worst thing in the world. You know, in Montgomery County, if you're a 12-year-old and you're playing in a park without a parent watching you, someone's going to call the police and the Child Protective Services. That's how overly protective people are today. But the point was, I really had the sense of being abandoned. I had the sense of being lost. I started to cry, I'm ashamed to say. So, what does mom do? Mom comes, and she hugs you, and she says, I'm here, I'm here, I'm here, don't worry, don't worry, don't worry. Now, if you approach this like a Brisker, and you analyze things, you're going to say, why does my mother have to say, I'm here three times? She said it once. Mimela, I know she's here. Answer, when your heart is broken, when you feel abandoned, when you feel scared, even if your head absorbs a certain amount of information, you have to hear it over and over and over again. That's what repetition is. Repetition is not just redundant. Repetition and redundancy are not the same. When something is redundant, that means there's no point in saying it again. But a lot of repetition is not redundant. A lot of times, we need to be reassured again and again and again. Because something can enter the head and not enter the heart, unless there's a constant reassurance. So you have to understand that Hashem repeating this over and over and over again is like the mother hugging the child and saying, I'm here, I'm here, I'm here. I'm never going to leave you. See? And therefore, the statement, Kefa lo inyan b'milim shonos, repeating something in different words, is not stam, just repeating. It's not redundant. It's a reassurance of love on a very deep emotional level. Right? So that's the idea of Shiva dinechemta. Okay, so now let me mention an interesting thought of Avudraham. As I said before, as you know, all seven Haftoros are taken from the Navi Yeshayahu, and it's really the last half of the book, the last third of the book, more or less. But they're not necessarily in order, meaning sometimes you have a later perek before. So let me mention a thought from the Avudraham, Rav David Avudraham, one of the Rishonim in the 1500s who wrote on Tefillah. It's often quoted by the Torah. And he says that just by looking at the first words of the each Haftorah, you can construct a kind of dialogue between Hashem, the prophets, and then the Jewish people. The first Haftorah, Nachamu, Nachamu, Ami. And people often mistranslate this. People say, Nachamu, Nachamu, Ami, people often translate it, Hashem is speaking to his people, be comforted. That's not the translation. Nachamu is a commandment to the prophets of Israel. Nachamu ami, go and comfort my people. So the Nevi'im are commanded, go and give comfort to my people. That is Haftorah number one. Haftorah number two that we read yesterday is the Navi's response back to God. Vatomer Tzion Azavani Hashem. When we went to comfort the people, they said back to us, Hashem has forsaken us. Hashem has abandoned us. That's what Tzion says. The third Haftorah, Aniya Soara Lo Nuchama. Now, Aniya Soara is actually a biblical pun, because Aniya with an Aleph means a boat. Aniya with an Ayin means the impoverished, suffering one. Now, Soara is storm-tossed. So you would expect Aniya Soara, the storm-tossed boat. And yet, Aniya is spelled with an Ayin. So actually, it's a pun. The storm-tossed, bereft woman, Lo Nuchama. Right? So, Haftorah number one, Hashem's commandment to the prophets. Haftorah number two, the Jewish people's response, Azavani Hashem. Haftorah number three, the Navi reporting back to Hashem, Aniya Sora Lo Nuchama. Haftorah number four, Anochi Anochi Hu Minachem Chem, meaning, if the Nevi'im cannot comfort, I myself will comfort. Hashem says, I will do the job. Haftorah number five is Hashem comforting us. Rani Akara, rejoice, barren one. Haftorah number 6 continues, Kumi Ori, rise and shine. Right, the English expression comes from this. And finally, Haftorah number 7, which is the Shabbos before Rosh Hashanah, the last Shabbos of the year, is Sos Asis Vashem. I am joyous in God's comforting. I have accepted it. So the Avudram therefore sees the first Haftorah, Hashem's mission to the prophet. The second Haftorah, the Jewish people's refusal to be comforted. The third Haftorah, the Navi reporting back to Hashem. The fourth Haftorah, Hashem says, I'm going to take on the job. The fifth and sixth is Hashem's comforting us. And the seventh Haftorah is our acknowledgement of Hashem's comfort. And the Avudram says, that's kind of a mnemonic by which you can actually remember the order of the Sheva de Nechemta. But one might ask a question, what does this Lamaisa mean? The Nevi'im were told to comfort us, and the Nevi'im then tell Hashem, we're not comforted, or that they're not comforted. So Hashem says, so I will do it myself. Well, what does it mean, I will do it myself? I mean, Hashem didn't speak to the Jewish people individually. In what way did Hashem do it himself? And the answer is, Hashem comforts broken spirits in many, many different ways. It's not going to usually be you're going to hear the voice of Hashem talking to you. I mean, if you hear the voices, we have a place in Givat Shaul for people. What's it called? The Jerusalem complex? Whatever. There's a whole psychiatric condition of people that feel that they're hearing God's voice speaking to them. But God's voice speaks to us in many, many different ways. It's not always a voice that you hear. But it's the courage, you know, you wake up in the morning and you're able to go on, you're able to rebuild. That's Hashem speaking to you. That's Hashem giving you koach to get married again after the Holocaust, to be able to come to a new culture and become a productive person. So Hashem is basically saying that I give you this koach and I give you this ability. That maybe b'derech hateva, you shouldn't be able to recover from these sorrows, but I will give you the power to do so. That's Hashem speaking to us. So Hashem speaks to us all the time. But as I say, not in the conscious sense of I hear a voice speaking to me. And again, people unfortunately do not have hakara satov in this sense. Why didn't Hashem answer my prayers? And why did this happen and that happen? But Hashem answers tefillos in many, many different ways, including giving a person the koach to be able to go on. Okay, so this is the meaning of Hashem giving us the comfort. And again, Rav Yaakov Emden remarked, this is way before the Holocaust, Rav Yaakov Emden remarked almost 300 years ago that the miracle of Jewish survival, in spite of the persecutions of all the nations of the world, is a greater miracle than Kriyas Yamsuf and the Ten Makos. And people say, well, why doesn't Hashem do miracles anymore? He did miracles in the Torah. Why doesn't he do miracles like he used to do? And Rav Yaakov Emden says, if you just contemplate how the Jewish people are still around, and we could add, after Rav Yaakov Emden, back in Eretz Yisrael, building up the land. Yes, as I said before, we're still in a galus, of course. Even here, we're in a galus. But to look at all of the chesed that Hashem has given us and the fact that we are around, Rebecca Benton says, that is a greater miracle than any of the miracles that are recorded in the Torah. And indeed, it's one of these not only the survival, but the flourishing of the Jewish people is one of the great, great enigmas of history. There was a famous British historian, Arnold Toynbee, who was an anti-Semite, very, very true, but he wrote a multi-volume series of books called The Study in History, in which he took 50 ancient civilizations, Egyptians, Sumerians, Assyrians, Hittites, and all the way to the Greeks and the Romans. And he was able to identify universal patterns that explained the rise of the civilization and the fall of the civilization. This was remarkable. He had to master hundreds of thousands of facts and put them together in patterns. And it was a work of genius in many, many ways. But when he came to fitting in the Jewish people into the pattern, they didn't fit. They didn't fit his theory. Because most of our history, we didn't have a common language, we weren't in a common territory. Meaning to say, he developed a theory that predicted the rise and the fall of civilizations. It explained 49 out of 50. It didn't explain the Jewish people. Now, my speculation is that's why he became an anti-Semite. You know, a guy invests 50 years of his life in a theory that explains 99% of the data, and this 1% is holding it up. Yeah, I would be pretty upset myself. So he couldn't explain it. According to his brilliant calculations, there should not have been a Jewish people. So because of this, he coined the phrase. He says the Jewish people are like a fossilized people, meaning to say, like you'd find a fly in amber, you'd find a dinosaur egg or something, meaning to say, yeah, you know, they shouldn't be around. And this itself was taken as an anti-Semitic remark, and those of you that are a bit older might remember that on American college campuses, Chaim Herzog engaged, Yaakov Herzog, the Talmud Chacham of the family, Yaakov Herzog engaged in a public debate with Toynbee, and this was the famous Herzog-Toynbee debate, whether Jews are a fossilized people or Jews are an integral part of the modern world. I believe there may even be some recordings on YouTube of the old Herzog-Toynbee debate. It was like famous. Just to show you Yerida Sadoros, that later got replaced by another debate, Lotkis Hamantaschen debate, meaning to say on a lot of universities now, they have an annual debate whether Lotkis is better than Hamantaschen. So Yerida Sadoros, or whatever. But this was the Herzog-Toynbee debate. So here's what I want to say. I want to say that I actually side with Toynbee over Herzog in the following way. Because if Toynbee's argument is, or was, that under the laws of history there ought not to be a Jewish people, and therefore the Jewish people do not belong in this world based on the normal processes of history, I would say he's right. The Jewish people existing in the world is a miraculous phenomenon. It is a supernatural phenomenon. If you look at the rise and fall of civilizations, there ought not to be a Jewish people. Now again, maybe he had anti-Semitic implications in what he was saying. That's a separate issue. But if his point is that historically there ought not to be Jews, yeah. That's right. And that itself, as Rav Yaakov Emden said, is the great, great raya, the great proof of Hashgacha Pratis that's even greater than Yitzias Mitzrayim and Kriyas Yamsuf. So in that sense, I think Toynbee actually had a very legitimate point. The Maharal makes the point at a much earlier stage, way before Rav Yaakov Emden. This is why a bris milah, the circumcision, is done on the eighth day, right? The eighth day. We know that the cycle of nature, natural time, is seven, because you have 6 days of creation, Shabbos, and then you begin again, right? So natural time runs in cycles of seven. Although it's interesting, it's not a physically natural phenomenon, meaning a week, it's very interesting. A month is a physical phenomenon of nature, at least approximately, because it represents the amount of time that the moon takes to go around the earth. A year is also, at least the solar year, is an astronomical phenomenon, because it's the amount of time, approximately, that the earth goes around the sun. So they have physical correspondences to nature. A week actually has no particular physical event that is associated with it. In other words, there is no cycle that is completed. Nevertheless, in the framework of time that Hashem created, Hashem did create a cycle of time that's based on seven. In fact, it is said that that's deeply ingrained in the human race as a whole, that there has to be a seventh day. Now, even though the Christians turned it to Sunday, but there has to be a seventh day of rest. Stalin, at one point, I had once read, in his attempt to totally uproot religion, wanted to put the Russians, or the Soviets, on a 10-day work week, meaning 9 days, and then a 10th day, and people could not live that way. There had to be this notion of a seventh day of rest. So, seven is the cycle of natural time. Eight is something that is above nature. Eight is above nature. In fact, the Maharal writes, the word uz yashir. Uz is Begematria 8, and it represents the Aleph, the one God, on top of the seven of time, right? So, eight is God above time. So the Maharal says, that's why in Yom Kippur, when the Kohen Gadol goes into the Kodesh HaKadoshim, he sprinkles the blood 8 times. Because tshuva is above nature. It's not a natural thing. Forgiveness. And that is why Bris Milah is 8. Because God's covenant with the Jewish people is supernatural. And it is above nature. Okay? And that is, again, so Toynbee is right. I will give credit where credit is due. Okay. So now, though, let me mention a final question. I may have to carry this over next week. The final question is this. Let's go back to the pattern. 3 haftoros of tragedy. 7 haftoros of comfort. And then haftoros of tshuva. Tragedy, comfort, tshuva. Now, the problem with that is not the pattern that the Torah itself describes. In yesterday's parsha, in V'eschanan, in a week ago's parsha, which we also read on Tisha B'Av, the Torah describes, ki solid banim uvnei banim, Moshe is telling us, when you will have children and grandchildren, noshantem, and you will live in the land for a long time, and you will do idols, worship idols, and do averos, God says, I will exile you, and you will be dispersed, and you will suffer. And from that suffering, you will realize that you must turn back to Hashem. Uvikashtem misham, es Hashem Elokecha. You will seek from the diaspora, from the galus, you will seek Hashem, and then Hashem will return to you, and Hashem will liberate you, and Hashem will bring you back to the land. So what is the sequence? Suffering gives rise to tshuva. Tshuva gives rise to redemption. So why do we say suffering, redemption, tshuva, when in fact it is tshuva that comes from the suffering that brings to redemption? So number one, this is the sequence of the Torah. Number two, the Rambam himself says Beferish. I don't need a better proof than the Torah, obviously, but the Rambam codifies in Hilchos Tshuva, Ein Yisrael Nigalin Ela B'Tshuva. Mashiach cannot come, there will not be a redemption until the Jewish people do tshuva. Now, how that's going to work seems to be an insurmountable problem in many, many ways. Baruch Hashem, more and more people are doing tshuva. And by the way, when I say tshuva, we also, even if you're from, you have to do tshuva. One shouldn't think that tshuva is only for those who are not shomer mitzvahs. Even people who are shomer mitzvahs, all of us have so much to do tshuva on. So however it's going to work, I mean, the Rambam gives you good news and bad news. Well, the bad news, the negative news is that we can't have Gula without tshuva. We're stuck. The good news is Hashem promises that we will all do tshuva. Now, how can Hashem make that promise is actually theologically very problematical. If Hakol Bidei Shemayim, if everything is in the hands of heaven, except the decision to serve God, God cannot make a promise we're all going to do tshuva. That's up to us. Be it as it may, as the Bisker Rebbe used to say, when Mashiach comes, we'll ask him the question, and he'll give us the answer. The Rambam says these two statements: we will not have Geula without Tshuva, but Hashem promises that the Jewish people will do Tshuva. Okay. So once again, same question. Why do the Haftorah say from tragedy comes redemption, and then there's Tshuva, when in fact the pattern is the tragedy brings the Tshuva, and the Tshuva brings the redemption? And the final proof is from Shemona Esrei. Let's look at the Amidah. Let's look at Shemona Esrei. Let's look at the order of the brachos of Shemona Esrei. So we say, Hashiveinu Avinu L'Seira Secha. Return us, Hashem, to your Torah. Meaning, inspire us to do tshuva. That, by the way, Hashem can do. Hashem cannot make you do tshuva, but Hashem can certainly give you inspiration in life. That much, that's not a contradiction to free will. That's based on the teaching, Habal L'Tayir Messiah, so meaning, if I want to purify myself, Hashem will help me. So when I turn to Hashem and I say, help me do tshuva, that is a legitimate prayer. Hashem will help you do tshuva if that's what you want to do. So, I then do tshuva. So what do I get from tshuva? I get forgiveness. Salach lanu. Right? The consequence of tshuva is forgiveness. And from that forgiveness, Re'eina v'ani'enu, see our affliction, Baruch Ata Hashem, Goel Yisrael, redemption. Same pattern. Tshuva, forgiveness, redemption. So both from the Chumash and from the Rambam and from the Siddur, we see a pattern that Geula comes when there is tshuva. So the kasha is, once again, why do the Haftoros create a pattern of suffering leads to redemption, and redemption leads to tshuva? It should be the opposite. Suffering leads to tshuva, and from tshuva you come to redemption. Now, granted, if you were to follow that order, it would be a little awkward with the calendar cycle, because that would mean we would be talking about Nechama during Yom Ha'aron. Okay, that's a question exactly. But still, the way the Haftorahs are giving you a pattern, it is not following the order in which these events are supposed to occur. So let me just start this. I'll finish it next week. Let's go back to Parshas V'eschanan for a moment. Oh, I'm sorry. Before I do that, let me digress for a moment. Digression, since I've had a lot of digressions today anyway. In the Parsha that I quoted before in V'eschanan, Ki solid banim uvnei banim v'nashantem ba'aretz. And this is an extremely important parsha. One should spend a lot of time reading that section of the parsha, because that is really the parsha that is explaining what Golus is about and what we learn from Golus and how Golus causes us to turn to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And you will notice there that there's a tshuva that we do in Golus that brings us back to Eretz Yisrael. And then there's a tshuva we do once we're back in Eretz Yisrael. And Rav Kook has a long, long arichos. He actually wants to say that the first tshuva that we experience in Golus, at least for some people, will not necessarily be turning to Hashem, but it will be wanting to be part of Am Yisrael and coming back to Eretz Yisrael. Again, this is Rav Kook's famous thesis, which not everybody accepts. And that is, Rav Kook took the position that even secular Zionism was ultimately a spiritual manifestation. Meaning, some people come to Eretz Yisrael because of their relationship to Hashem, and some will come to Hashem through their relationship to Eretz Yisrael. It's the hook by which Hashem gets their neshamos connected to him. So even if a 19th century Herzl type Zionist would think in terms of nationalism, normalcy, all the different arguments for a Jewish state, really it's their neshama wanting to be connected to God, even if they don't believe in God, or even if they think they don't believe in God. And therefore, Rav Kook points out, real tshuva to Hashem only occurs once you're back, but there will be a preliminary tshuva that will bring you to Eretz Yisrael. Now again, this was one of Rav Kook's more controversial teachings, in which he saw holiness in every aspect of the Zionist endeavor, even when it was perverted because it involved Chilul Shabbos and various other things. He says that was the nature of the soul being in Golos, in which sometimes Kedusha will be distorted in some ways. But that does not obscure the fact that fundamentally building up Eretz Yisrael was an act of holiness, an act of goodness, an act of Kedusha. As they say, obviously there will be people who will disagree with some of this, but this is this was Rav Kook's famous teaching. But on the pasuk that says, "V'nayshantem ba'aretz," you will be habituated, you will be old in the land, Rashi gives us a very interesting gematria. V'noshantem, if you add up the gematria, spells 852. Now, how many years were the Jewish people in the land of Israel before the Chorban? We can actually figure this out, because the most important chronological piece of data in Tanakh is in the Book of Malachim. This is the source of all rabbinic chronology for the Bayis Rishon. The first Beis HaMikdash was built, it says in the Book of Malachim, 480 years after the Jewish people left Mitzrayim. So, if the Beis HaMikdash was built 480 years after the Jewish people left Mitzrayim, and we wandered in the desert for 40 years, so that means the Beis HaMikdash was built after we were in Eretz Yisrael 440 years. It's 480 minus 40. We know that the Bayis Rishon stood 410. So, from the time Yehoshua crossed the Yarden until the Chorban Beis HaMikdash is 850 years. But L'chora, V'noshantem, was God's promise. We would be old in the land. The gematria of V'noshantem is 852 years. So Rashi brings a medrash that Hashem destroyed the Beis HaMikdash 2 years earlier than was the original plan. Why? Because had we been there for V'noshantem, the pasuk says, "I will utterly destroy you." You will. So Hashem brought the Chorban 2 years early. Now, why 2 years? I don't know why 2 years, but he brought it 2 years early, so he wouldn't have to fulfill the devastation of Hashchis Tashchisun. Now, there is a very interesting lesson here, that you might think, if you were living at the time and the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed after 850, you would say, oh, look how unfair God is. God promised us 852. And he brings the tragedy early. But you see that even in the early tragedy, there was a certain chesed of Hashem that he would not be Makayim Hashcheis Tashchisun. Okay. All right. Now again, I'm in the middle of a question and an answer. Again, let me just leave you with the question that we're going to answer next week. I thought the question would be sure today, but okay, perhaps we would have another thing. The question, once again, is that the pattern of the Haftoros are 3 tragedy, 7 comfort, and then tshuva. But the problem is, the Torah, the Rambam, the Siddur, all go with the idea that from tragedy we come to tshuva, and from tshuva we come to comfort. So why in the order of the Haftoros is the comfort earlier than the tshuva, when in fact the comfort and the redemption have to come after the tshuva? Okay, that is the question. You can agonize it over a whole week, and Mr. Shem, next week we'll talk about it.